Life is unpredictable, but preparing for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. They offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to PolicyGenius.com. That's PolicyGenius.com.
Welcome to The Deep Dive, the show where we try to cut through the noise and really equip you with the knowledge you need to be truly well-informed.
That's the goal.
So today we're embarking on an exploration into one of America's most pivotal and I think profoundly complex presidents, Thomas Woodrow Wilson. You might recognize his name, maybe for his, you know, soaring vision of global peace or for fundamentally reshaping the American government right here at home.
Right, those big legacy items.
But as is always the case with these truly transformative figures in history, a closer look reveals, well, a far more intricate picture. It's filled with surprising insights, intense conflicts, and some very difficult truths that still resonate today.
Indeed. Wilson's two terms, they spanned the tumultuous early decades of the 20th century, and they just left an indelible mark, both on American domestic policy and its emergent role on the international stage. He was a figure of immense ambition, immense intellect, a true scholar-turned-statesman, you could say. But also, as we'll, you know, unpack, a man whose principles and prejudices presented these stark, sometimes really jarring contradictions.
That's right. And for this deep dive, we've pulled together, well, a pretty rich stack of sources, everything from detailed biographical accounts, his own writings, to incisive historical analyses.
Yeah, good mix.
These materials cover his entire life, really, offering us a comprehensive lens through which to view his journey.
So our mission today is basically to guide you through Wilson's remarkable trajectory from his early days as a Southern academic, then through his kind of unexpected rise in politics as a progressive reformer,
right,
into the ambitious domestic transformation of his new freedom agenda, and then finally, his pivotal and, let's be honest, controversial leadership during World War I and that subsequent quest for world peace.
And crucially, we'll also be critically examining the enduring, often contradictory aspects of his legacy. We have to pay particular attention to his deeply troubling record on civil rights.
Absolutely essential. Can't avoid it.
We really aim to give you a thorough, nuanced understanding of a president who truly, truly changed the game. So, okay, let's unpack this and maybe start right at the very beginning. To really understand Woodrow Wilson, I think we absolutely have to start by grounding him in his origins.
Makes sense.
He was born Thomas Woodrow Wilson, December 28, 1856, Staunton, Virginia. Mm. But more than just, you know, a birthplace, his upbringing was just deeply intertwined with one of the most defining and, frankly, traumatic periods in American history.
Mm.
He grew up squarely in the American South, right in the thick of the Civil War and the subsequent Reconstruction era.
Yeah, a difficult time.
An incredibly difficult time, a period of immense social, political, economic upheaval. And its impact on the young Wilson, particularly on his worldview and his later perspectives, well, it was absolutely profound. You can't overstate it.
It's quite striking when you consider that Wilson wasn't just a Southerner by birth, but someone whose life literally began within the Confederacy.
Wow.
He holds that rare distinction, one of only two U.S. presidents, the other being John Tyler, who were actually citizens of the Confederate States of America during its, you know, short existence.
That fact alone just speaks volumes, doesn't it? About the environment that shaped him.
It really does.
And the stories from his early childhood, they just reinforce this. His earliest vivid memory, he was just 3 years old, was hearing a passerby announce Abraham Lincoln's election and the imminent arrival of war, right from the front gate of his home in Augusta, Georgia.
Imagine that at three.
Right. Imagine the raw emotional resonance of that moment for a young child. His foundational memories being linked to such a monumental national crisis, the coming storm. It certainly suggests an early intense exposure to the, well, the grand theater of politics and conflict.
And that familial and regional background, it really provided a deep well of influence. His father, Joseph Ruggles Wilson, he was a prominent Presbyterian pastor and an unyielding supporter of the Confederacy.
Unyielding is the word.
Yeah. He went so far as to be one of the founders of the Presbyterian Church in the Confederate States of America. This wasn't just passive acceptance of Southern ideology. It was active, intellectual, spiritual endorsement.
Mm.
So this environment, steeped in the intellectual and moral arguments of the Confederacy, undeniably shapes the young Woodrow's understanding of society, governance, and, crucially, race.
Can't separate.
No. The family also had Scotch-Irish and Scottish roots, grandparents who'd immigrated from Ireland and Scotland, a pretty common heritage, actually, among many prominent American figures of that era.
So from this really deeply Southern upbringing, Wilson then pivots, quite sharply actually, into the intellectual world of academia.
Right, a big shift.
He started his higher education at Davidson College, but then transferred to the College of New Jersey, which of course later became the renowned Princeton University.
His alma mater.
Exactly. And there, he truly immersed himself in studying political philosophy and history. But even in his undergraduate years, he showed these clear signs of natural leadership abilities.
Oh, yeah.
He served as secretary of the Football Association, president of the Baseball Association, managing editor of the student newspaper. He clearly wasn't just a bookworm. He was engaged, an influential figure on campus life, already hinting at a future beyond the lecture hall.
After graduating from Princeton in 1879, his path took a brief and I think ultimately revealing detour. He went to the University of Virginia School of Law, but poor health forced him to withdraw from that program.
Ah.
Then he made a brief attempt at practicing law in Atlanta in 1882. Now, this phase raises a really interesting question about his core personality, doesn't it?
Likewise.
Well, what does it tell us about the future president that he so quickly abandoned a traditional practical career path like law for purely intellectual pursuits?
Good point. He wasn't suited to it.
He explicitly stated he found the day-to-day procedural aspects of law abhorrent. He preferred, quote, leisure for reading and for original work.
Okay, so it wasn't just a career change. It was like a declaration of his whole temperament.
Exactly. A preference for abstract thought, systemic analysis, theoretical reform, over the gritty, incremental work of the courtroom. This intellectual bent, this desire to shape systems rather than just navigate their intricacies, that would become such a defining characteristic of his leadership.
He certainly pursued that intellectual path with, well, singular dedication. In late 1883, he enrolled at Johns Hopkins University for doctoral studies, really focused intensely on history, political science, and German.
Right.
And it was during this period, truly a formative intellectual crucible for him, that he produced his groundbreaking work, Congressional Government, a Study in American Politics. That came out in 1885.
And it wasn't just, you know, well-received. It was hailed by one prominent critic as the best critical writing on the American Constitution, which has appeared since the Federalist Papers.
Wow, that's high praise for a young scholar.
Extremely high praise. It critically examined the American system, argued for a more parliamentary-style government, something that could respond more directly to public will. It was a bold, influential critique.
His intellectual journey then culminated in 1886, when he earned his PhD in history and government,
making him, as you alluded to earlier, the only U.S. president in the nation's history to possess a doctorate.
The only one.
This academic rigor, this deep theoretical understanding of political systems, governance, history, it would profoundly inform his approach to leadership, both as a university president and eventually as president of the United States. He wasn't just observing politics. He was, like, conceptualizing it.
And amidst all these really demanding academic endeavors, Wilson also found time to build a family. He met and fell deeply in love with Ellen Louise Axon, the daughter of a Presbyterian minister back in 1883. Mm. They got married in 1885, established a partnership that would prove to be a really crucial support system for his ambitious career.
And Ellen was, well, far more than just a supportive spouse. What's truly compelling here is Ellen's own intellectual and artistic accomplishments and the depth of her dedication.
She was an artist.
Oh, yes, an accomplished artist in her own right. She even received a medal from the Exposition Universelle in Paris. That's a significant international recognition. Yet she made the conscious decision to sacrifice her artistic pursuits for marriage and to support Woodrow's burgeoning career.
That's quite a sacrifice.
It really was. Her commitment was so profound, she even learned German specifically to help translate complex political science publications for Woodrow's research.
Wow.
So this wasn't just a domestic partnership. It was an intellectual alliance, really. Even if one partner's career clearly took precedence, it kind of underscores the shared ambition that defined their life together.
They went on to have three daughters, Margaret, Jessie, and Eleanor. Sadly, though, Ellen's health began to decline after Wilson became president.
Right, that was tragic.
And she died in 1914, just a year and a half into his first term. This loss, as you read in many accounts, deeply affected him, cast a real shadow over his early presidency, It's clear his family life, despite his intense and demanding public career, remained a profound, central part of his personal world.
So following his doctoral studies, Wilson's academic career really started to flourish. He taught at Bryn Mawr College, then Wesleyan University,
right,
where he showed a broader engagement beyond just pure scholarship. He even coached football and founded a debate team.
Oh, football coach too. Didn't know that.
Yeah. He wasn't just stuck in the ivory tower. He was actively shaping young minds, fostering intellectual engagement. Then in 1890, he returned to his alma mater, Princeton, appointed chair of jurisprudence and political economy.
Back home, so to speak.
Exactly. And there he quickly earned this reputation, not just as a brilliant scholar, but as a truly compelling, charismatic speaker.
His intellectual contributions during this time were pretty substantial, weren't they? Right. Laying theoretical groundwork for future progressive reforms.
Oh, absolutely. He published extensively, including The State, a textbook that was widely adopted in American colleges for decades.
Really?
Yeah. And in this work, he argued quite forcefully that governments had a legitimate, essential role in promoting the general welfare through regulations on child labor, factory conditions, women's health, product quality.
So connecting this to the bigger picture, these weren't just abstract academic theories then.
Not at all. He was actively, as you put it, laying the groundwork for the modern welfare state, advocating for government intervention for social good long before those ideas gained widespread political traction. It shows a clear evolution in his thinking about the scope, the responsibility of government.
And he further cemented his reputation as a leading historian with Division and Reunion, published in 1893, became a standard textbook for U.S. history.
Right. So by this point, his intellectual prowess, his leadership potential, they were undeniable. It's really no surprise then that in 1902, he was promoted to president of Princeton University.
A role he approached with this ambitious, almost revolutionary reformist zeal.
That's a good way to put it. His stated goal for Princeton, and really for higher education more broadly, was profound. To transform thoughtless boys performing tasks into thinking men.
Lofty goal. How did he try to achieve it?
Well, by rigorously raising admission standards, emphasizing serious intellectual engagement over just coasting along for that gentleman's see that was so common among the elite back then.
Uh-huh.
To do this, he instituted academic departments, developed core curriculum requirements, and perhaps most innovatively, introduced the preceptorial system.
The preceptorial system, what was that?
Students met in small, intimate groups with teaching assistants, preceptors for more personalized instruction. It was a pretty radical departure for the era, designed to foster deeper critical thinking.
Interesting.
And he also proved to be a highly successful fundraiser, secured significant donations from prominent alumni like Moses Taylor Pine, philanthropists like Andrew Carnegie, showed he could really garner support for his vision.
And he wasn't afraid to challenge Princeton's, you know, deeply entrenched traditional structures either. He made groundbreaking appointments.
Right.
Bringing in the university's first Jew and first Roman Catholic to the faculty. And he actively worked to liberate the Board of Trustees from what he saw as the stifling influence of conservative Presbyterians. Mm. It all paints this picture of a truly forward-thinking, progressive educational reformer.
However, and this is a crucial and deeply troubling counterpoint here, one that unfortunately foreshadows a significant aspect of his presidential legacy.
Okay.
Despite these other progressive reforms, Wilson actively worked to keep African Americans out of Princeton.
Really? Even as others were starting to integrate?
Exactly. Even as other Ivy League institutions like Harvard and Yale were beginning, albeit in very small numbers, to accept black students. This decision stands in stark, painful contrast to his other efforts to broaden and modernize the university. It reveals a deep-seated racial bias that would have lasting consequences.
That's a critical piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
It really reveals the profound contradictions in his progressive vision.
Mm.
And his tenure at Princeton, despite its successes, was also marked by fierce internal battles, wasn't it?
Oh, definitely. He experienced significant clashes, perhaps most notably a bitter dispute over his ambitious plan to abolish the entrenched upper-class eating clubs.
The eating clubs, right. Very Princeton.
Very Princeton. He wanted to relocate students into residential quadrangles, believing it would foster a more democratic, intellectually focused environment. But this was met with fierce alumni opposition.
It isn't like that.
Not at all. It was ultimately withdrawn, a rare but significant defeat for him. He even became estranged from his close friend and chief advisor, John Greer Hibben, over another reform plan. These incidents underscore a certain rigidity in his approach, maybe, a tendency to push his vision uncompromisingly, even at the cost of personal relationships.
And there were personal challenges during this period too, his health.
Right. His health began to decline around 1906. He experienced what modern medical opinion strongly surmises was a stroke.
A stroke while president of Princeton?
Yeah. It left him blind in his left eye, and perhaps as a direct consequence, contributed to an increase in his impatience, his intolerance. Personality traits that would become more pronounced later in life. It's a stark reminder of how deeply personal health can impact public service and leadership.
Life is unpredictable, but how you prepare for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. Whether to cover debts and routine expenses or even invest the money and earn interest over time. With Policy Genius, finding and buying life insurance is simple. You can compare quotes from top insurers and could find coverage that fits your needs and your budget. Plus, they offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. It's an easy way to feel good about and plan for the future. No wonder Policy Genius is the country's leading online insurance marketplace. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to PolicyGenius.com to compare top-rated life insurance policies, get your lowest quote, and make a smart move in under 10 minutes. That's PolicyGenius.com.
Style.
So it was this growing disenchantment, this frustration with the stubborn resistance to his reforms at Princeton that really spurred his political ambitions then.
Seems that way. By 1910, he started dropping clear hints of interest in a political ticket, signaled a desire to move from reforming a university to reforming the broader society.
And what a pivot it was. By January 1910, leaders in New Jersey's Democratic Party, figures like James Smith Jr., George Britton McClellan Harvey, they saw him as an ideal candidate for governor.
Why him specifically?
Well, they hoped his academic reputation and, frankly, his perceived political naivete would make him a strong, articulate voice against trusts and corruption, while also believing his inexperience would make him easy to influence, easy to control. They saw a figurehead, not a force.
Ah, the classic party boss calculation. How'd that work out for them?
Okay, not well. Wilson, however, had his own very clear terms. He immediately signaled his independent streak. He famously accepted the nomination only if, quote, "it came to me unsought, unanimously, and without pledges to anybody about anything."
Wow. Setting the terms right from the start.
Exactly. He wasn't going to be anyone's puppet. He quickly shed that professorial aloofness, campaigned vigorously on a platform of independence from party bosses, and presented himself as a full-fledged progressive committed to real change.
And his strategy paid off.
Handsomely. Won a landslide victory by over 65,000 votes. Astonishing, really, considering the state had gone Republican in the previous presidential election.
Huge win.
But it was his first act as governor that truly defined his approach and just shocked the party establishment.
What did he do?
Upon winning, he immediately broke with the very party bosses who had nominated him, dramatically refused to endorse James Smith Jr.'s bid for the U.S. Senate, and instead threw his weight behind the primary winner.
Ooh, burn. That sent a message.
A huge message. This bold, decisive action strategically positioned him as an independent force, demonstrated unequivocally he was beholden to no one but the people.
So New Jersey at that time, it had this unflattering nickname, right? The Mother of Trusts.
That's right. Notoriously lax antitrust laws, very corporate-friendly environment.
So Wilson, true to his reformist spirit, he wasted no time. He pushed through a remarkable suite of progressive reforms.
Like what kind of reforms?
Well, the Jaron Bill, mandating primaries for all elective offices, a robust corrupt practices law limiting campaign expenditures, prohibiting corporate contributions. He signed a pioneering workers' compensation law.
Big deal for workers, then.
Huge. Enacted laws restricting labor by women and children, significantly increased factory working condition standards. Critical steps toward worker protection in that era of rapid industrialization.
His reform agenda was incredibly broad, it seems.
It really was. He established a new state board of education with significant powers, oversaw the creation of free dental clinics, a comprehensive and scientific poor law aimed at rationalizing welfare provision.
Wow.
Mandated that railroads pay employees twice monthly, introduced sweeping regulations on working hours, health, safety, employment age, and mercantile establishments. And critically, he enacted the Seven Sisters antitrust laws, specifically targeting corporate monopolies within New Jersey.
And he removed the power of local sheriffs, to select juries. Why was that important?
That was designed to reduce political influence in the justice system, make it fairer, less beholden to local bosses.
His success then in passing all these wide-ranging reforms just in his first months in office.
Yeah.
That must have gotten him noticed.
Oh, absolutely. It quickly garnered him national recognition as a leading reformer, a powerful new voice in the progressive movement. It's clear his time in New Jersey demonstrated not just his ability to articulate progressive academic ideas, but his formidable skill in translating those ideas into tangible, impactful legislative action. Really set the stage for an even bigger role on the national stage.
Wilson's remarkable success in New Jersey, it just catapulted him onto the national political stage, didn't it? Made him a prominent presidential contender almost overnight.
It really did. He garnered support from a diverse coalition, progressives, Southerners who found his transplanted Southerner status appealing, thought he could bridge regional divides.
And a key figure in his meteoric rise was Edward M. House.
Ah, Colonel House.
Right, a shrewd political operative from Texas.
Yeah.
Managed his campaign, later became his most influential chief advisor in the White House, famously declined a cabinet position to operate, you know, outside the formal structures.
Always behind the scenes, pulling strings.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the 1912 presidential election itself, arguably one of the most fascinating pivotal elections in American history. Truly a watershed moment.
Why so pivotal?
Well, Wilson faced a deeply fractured Republican Party. It was split between the incumbent, William Howard Taft, and the immensely popular former president, Theodore Roosevelt.
TR ran third party.
Yep, ran a powerful third party campaign as the Bull Moose nominee. This unprecedented schism within the Republican ranks was without a doubt a major, maybe the deciding factor in Wilson's eventual victory. It essentially handed the election to the Democrats.
Wow, talk about lucky timing.
Right, and Wilson's campaign platform, which he famously dubbed the New Freedom, it was meticulously developed with help from the brilliant legal scholar Louis Brandeis.
Who later became a Supreme Court justice.
The very same. The New Freedom focused primarily on breaking up large industrial trusts and significantly lowering tariff rates.
How did that compare to Roosevelt's platform?
It offered a distinct contrast to Roosevelt's new nationalism, which, while also progressive, proposed a powerful federal bureaucracy that would regulate rather than dismantle large corporations. So it was a clear choice between two very different visions of how to tackle concentrated economic power and reform capitalism.
Interesting distinction. Regulation versus breakup.
Exactly. Ultimately, benefiting from that Republican split, Wilson secured a decisive victory, got 42% of the popular vote, but a commanding 435 electoral votes.
So not a majority of the popular vote, but a huge electoral win.
Right. And his win was historic in multiple ways. First Southerner elected president since 1848, first Democrat since Grover Cleveland, and uniquely still the only U.S. president to hold a Ph.D.
That academic background really distinguished him, signaled a new era of intellectualism in the White House, perhaps.
Once in the Oval Office, Wilson quickly assembled his cabinet, his close circle of advisors. He appointed the venerable William Jennings Bryan.
The great commoner.
Right. A titan of the Democratic Party. Three-time presidential nominee as his Secretary of State. William Gibbs McAdoo, skilled financier, politician, who would later marry Wilson's daughter.
Oh, really? Kept it in the family.
Huh, yeah. He was appointed Secretary of the Treasury, became a critical figure in his administration.
And it's particularly important, I think, for understanding Wilson's complex legacy to highlight the appointment of Josephus Daniels as Secretary of the Navy.
Why him?
Well, Daniels wasn't just a party loyalist. He was also a prominent white supremacist from North Carolina.
Ah, that's crucial.
It is, because his presence and that of others with similar views directly impacted Wilson's administrative decisions regarding race, especially since a young Franklin D. Roosevelt served as Daniels' assistant secretary.
Wow, FDR worked under him.
Yep. Joseph Patrick Tumulty served as chief of staff, and as you mentioned, Colonel Edward M. House, though holding no formal cabinet spot, was his most trusted, influential foreign policy advisor, often operated with greater sway than many actual cabinet members.
Wilson, ever the energetic reformer, wasn't one to waste time. He immediately introduced this unprecedented, comprehensive program of domestic legislation, a bold agenda aimed at fundamentally transforming American society and economy.
Mm-hmm.
And breaking with a long-standing tradition, going back to John Adams, he revived the practice of delivering his proposals to a joint session of Congress in person.
Showing his direct leadership.
Exactly. Signaling his determination to push his agenda forward. He called this his New Freedom Domestic Agenda, and it truly aimed for sweeping changes.
His first major priority, a cornerstone of the new freedom, was tariff reform. Democrats had for generations viewed high tariffs as unfair taxes, benefiting powerful industrial interests, stifling competition.
Right.
Wilson articulated this clearly, argued they cut us off from our proper part in the commerce of the world. The resulting Revenue Act of 1913, also known as the Underwood Tariff, was truly significant.
How so?
It cut average tariff rates by 10%, the largest downward revision since the Civil War. A bold move signaling a shift away from protectionism.
So what does this all mean then for the American economic landscape and the government's evolving role within it?
Well, this wasn't just adjusting the federal budget. It was a profound ideological reorientation.
Mm.
For generations, tariffs were both a primary revenue source and a protective shield for nascent American industries.
Right.
By shifting government revenue to an income tax, which the act also introduced.
The first income tax.
Well, the first modern federal income tax under the 16th Amendment, a modest 1% tax on incomes above $3,000, affecting only the wealthiest 3% at the time.
Okay.
Wilson effectively declared a new era. This move signaled a nascent progressive view of government's role in redistribution. The burden of funding would increasingly fall on individual wealth, not just imported goods. Subtly laying the groundwork for how a more interventionist, socially-minded federal government could fund its future programs. It was a durable impact on the U.S. economy that continues today.
Building on this, banking reform was next on his agenda, an urgent priority, really, highlighted by that devastating 1907 financial crisis.
Right. The panic of 1907.
The U.S. was, quite remarkably, one of the few major industrialized nations without a central bank, a fact that just exacerbated financial instability. Wilson sought a delicate middle ground.
Between
the powerful private banking sector and populist calls for complete public control. He famously declared the system must be public, not private, and must be vested in the government itself. Recognized the need for both stability and democratic accountability.
So how did he achieve that balance?
The Federal Reserve Act of 1913, signed into law just before Christmas. It was really a masterpiece of political compromise.
Okay.
It created 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, largely controlled by private banks within their districts. But critically, it established a central Federal Reserve Board appointed by the president.
Ah, the public oversight piece.
Exactly. This board exercised broad oversight, acted as a critical buffer against purely private interests. This system not only brought much-needed stability to the nation's chaotic financial system, but also played a key, albeit controversial, role in financing World War I just a few years later.
This raises an important question, though. How did this complex hybrid system manage to balance those fiercely competing interests? Wall Street, populace fearing centralized power, the government's need for control, while simultaneously creating a stable financial system that, well, still functions at the heart of our economy today.
It's a testament to his ability, I think, to navigate complex political waters and forge lasting institutions.
Wilson then turned his formidable attention to antitrust legislation. He wanted to strengthen the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, which had proven largely ineffective against the massive industrial trusts and monopolies of the era.
He thought they stifled competition.
Right, harmed the common citizen. He championed the Clayton Antitrust Act in 1914, a far more robust piece of legislation. It banned specific anti-competitive practices like discriminatory pricing, tying contracts, and interlocking directorates.
What's interlocking directorates?
That allowed individuals to sit on the boards of competing companies, obviously anti-competitive.
Right, right. And he didn't just stop at passing new laws. He created entirely new institutions to ensure their enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
He established the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, in 1914. This independent regulatory agency was tasked with investigating and enforcing antitrust laws, operating independently of the Justice Department.
So a powerful expansion of federal regulatory power.
Definitely. Showed his deep commitment not just to regulating economic behavior, but to fostering a truly level economic playing field and protecting consumers from unfair practices.
Now, on the fronts of labor and agriculture, Wilson's stance showed a notable capacity for political evolution.
How so? He wasn't initially pro-labor.
Initially, he harbored serious doubts about the constitutionality of a federal child labor law, believed it infringed on states' rights. However, due to intense political pressure from progressive activists and the approaching 1916 election, he reversed his position.
Political reality kicked in.
You could say that. He realized the immense popularity of such a measure, especially among emerging women voters who were gaining political influence. The Keating-Owen Act of 1916 was thus enacted the first federal child labor law, though tragically it was later struck down by the Supreme Court.
Still a significant step. What else on labor?
He also signed La Follette's Seamen's Act of 1915, a landmark piece of legislation that significantly upgraded working conditions, safety standards, pay for merchant sailors, addressed long-standing abuses in the maritime industry. Hmm. When faced with labor disputes, he wasn't afraid to intervene, even dispatched soldiers to the violent Colorado Coalfield War in 1914, trying to restore order amidst a brutal confrontation between miners and owners.
And in 1916, under the threat of a nationwide railroad strike, he pushed Congress to pass the Adamson Act, mandated an 8-hour workday for railroad workers. That was described by some as the boldest intervention in labor relations that any president had yet attempted. And despite his personal dislike for what he perceived as excessive government involvement, he also signed the Federal Farm Loan Act in 1916, created a system of low-interest loan banks for farmers, again demonstrating political pragmatism in securing the crucial farm vote.
Interesting. So, moving to territories, Wilson articulated a clear policy shift away from overt colonialism.
Yeah, he embraced a policy against outright owning colonies, instead worked for gradual autonomy and eventual independence for the Philippines through the Jones Act of 1916, which promised future self-governance.
Mm-hmm. But he did acquire territory.
He did. He purchased the Danish West Indies in 1916, renamed them the U.S. Virgin Islands, secured a strategic naval base there.
Okay. And what about immigration?
Life is unpredictable, but preparing for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. They offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to PolicyGenius.com. That's PolicyGenius.com.
His stance there.
Interestingly, he generally favored what were then called new immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe, often face opposition from nativist elements.
Right, the anti-immigrant sentiment was strong then.
Very. He twice vetoed restrictive immigration laws that sought to impose literacy tests, though one of his vetoes was overridden by Congress.
And his judicial appointments. You said they were a mixed bag.
Yeah, to say the least. Reflected the complexities of the legal and political landscape, he made three Supreme Court appointments. James Clark McReynolds, a conservative whom Wilson would later famously lament as his biggest mistake.
Ouch.
Then Louise Brandeis, a groundbreaking appointment, the first Jewish nominee to the Supreme Court, a leading progressive voice. His nomination sparked intense public debate.
I can imagine.
And John Hessen Clark, another progressive justice. So this is fascinating because it shows a definite mix of outcomes in his judicial selections, highlights the unpredictability and the lasting impact of those choices.
Okay, so moving now from Wilson's ambitious domestic transformation to the world stage, his foreign policy presented this fascinating, if at times deeply problematic, blend of idealism and interventionism, particularly in Latin America.
Right. He explicitly rejected his predecessor Taft's dollar diplomacy, which focused on using economic power to exert influence.
Yeah, he said he wouldn't do that. Yet, ironically, Wilson frequently intervened militarily in Latin American affairs, famously stating in 1913 with a rather paternalistic tone, "I am going to teach the South American republics to elect good men."
Wow, that sounds condescending.
It does. And the self-appointed mission led to significant military involvement throughout the region. For example, he essentially made Nicaragua a de facto protectorate, securing U.S. financial control. He occupied the Dominican Republic for 8 years.
8 years.
8 years. Intervened repeatedly in Haiti, Cuba, Panama, Honduras. These actions, often justified by a desire to promote stability and democracy, were deeply resented by the nations involved. And they highlight a complex, often contradictory approach to foreign policy, where his ideals of democratic self-determination sometimes translated into direct military imposition and a perceived American exceptionalism.
He also inherited the volatile situation of the ongoing Mexican Revolution, right?
Oh, yes. After refusing to recognize Victoriano Huerta's government of butchers following a military coup, Wilson eventually recognized Venustiano Carranza's constitutionalist government. But relations remained incredibly tense.
And things escalated dramatically with Pancho Villa.
Exactly. Pancho Villa, a revolutionary general whom Wilson had at one point considered a potential ally, even described him as a sort of Robin Hood.
Huh, really?
Yep. Villa raided Columbus, New Mexico in March 1916, killing American citizens. In response, Wilson dispatched General John J. Pershing and thousands of troops on the punitive expedition pursuing Villa deep into Mexico.
How'd that go?
Well, the pursuit led to several bloody incidents that nearly caused a full-scale war between the two nations before American troops were eventually withdrawn, a stark reminder of the volatile nature of his foreign policy.
Then came the seismic event that would ultimately redefine his presidency and America's role in the world. World War I erupted with stunning speed in July 1914.
Right. And Wilson's immediate primary foreign policy objective at the outbreak of this catastrophic conflict was steadfast. Keep the United States out of the war.
Mm-hmm. Neutrality.
And if possible, broker a lasting peace among the belligerents. He insisted on strict neutrality, famously urging Americans to be impartial in thought as well as in action.
But maintaining that strict neutrality proved to be, well, an immense and ultimately impossible challenge.
Why impossible?
The British Royal Navy's comprehensive blockade of Germany severely restricted American trade with the Central Powers. Then Germany's subsequent decision to employ unrestricted submarine warfare that directly challenged American sovereignty and the rights of neutral shipping.
Ah, the U-boats.
Exactly. The sinking of the British ocean liner RMS Lusitania in May 1915 that resulted in the deaths of 11,198 passengers, including 128 American citizens, that was a pivotal, deeply emotional moment for the American public.
Huge turning point. How did Wilson respond?
His initial public response was measured, but widely criticized. He famously said, "There is such a thing as a man being too proud to fight," a statement many perceived as weak in the face of such a tragedy.
Too proud to fight. Yeah, that didn't go over well.
No. His strong demand that Germany prevent similar incidents, a demand that seemed to prioritize American trade rights and citizen safety over absolute neutrality, led directly to the resignation of its Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan.
Bryan resigned over this.
Yes. Bryan, a staunch pacifist, felt Wilson was dangerously steering the nation towards war.
Wow.
The torpedoing of yet another passenger ship, the SS Sussex, in March 1916, finally led Wilson to extract the Sussex Pledge from Germany.
The Sussex Pledge.
A major diplomatic concession where Germany promised to warn passenger ships before sinking them and ensure passenger safety. A significant diplomatic victory for Wilson, actually. But what's truly insightful here is how Wilson's initial unwavering commitment to strict neutrality gradually but inexorably shifted.
What caused the shift?
Well, this evolution was particularly spurred by the growing preparedness movement at home, advocating for military readiness. And it manifested in concrete actions like expanding the U.S. Army through the National Defense Act of 1916 and the Massive Naval Act of 1916. The tide of public and political opinion was clearly turning towards intervention.
So, despite the growing tensions and the increasing likelihood of war, Wilson was renominated without opposition for the Democratic presidential ticket in 1916.
Right. And he shrewdly campaigned heavily on his impressive progressive domestic platform and, crucially, on that popular slogan, "He kept us out of war."
Ah, the famous slogan. Did it work?
Narrowly. He defeated Republican Charles Evans Hughes in a very close election, secured his second term on the strength of that peace message, even though the storm clouds of war were gathering ever more darkly.
But the peace, as we know, wouldn't last. January 1917, Germany made the fateful, ultimately disastrous decision to resume unrestricted submarine warfare.
Why would they do that? They knew it would bring the U.S. in.
It was a calculated gamble. They knew it would likely provoke U.S. entry, but they believed it necessary to win the war quickly before America could fully mobilize. Public opinion, already wary, was further inflamed by the revelation of the Zimmermann telegram in February.
The Zimmermann telegram. Right. Yeah. Germany trying to get Mexico to attack the U.S.
Exactly. A secret German diplomatic communication proposing an alliance with Mexico against the U.S. in exchange for lost territories like Texas, Arizona, New Mexico. It was a shocking betrayal that electrified the American public and firmly turned the tide towards war.
So after a series of devastating attacks on American merchant ships, Wilson's cabinet
unanimously agreed it was time to enter the conflict.
On April 2, 1917, Wilson stood before a joint session of Congress, delivered one of the most consequential speeches in American history, asking for a declaration of war against Germany.
What was his justification?
He articulated this soaring, idealistic vision for America's purpose, stating, "We have no selfish ends to serve. We desire no conquest, no dominion. We are but one of the champions of the rights of mankind."
Powerful words.
The declaration passed with strong bipartisan support, and America, no longer neutral, was officially plunged into the maelstrom of the Great War.
As a wartime president, Wilson immediately launched a massive expansion of the army. The Selective Service Act of 1917 swiftly drafted nearly 3 million men into military service, a scale just unprecedented in U.S. history.
Wow, 3 million.
The Navy also saw tremendous growth, became a formidable force. With America now committed, Wilson needed to articulate a clear vision for the post-war world, not just for Americans, but for the global community. He did so in his famous 14-point speech in January 1918.
The 14 points, what were the highlights?
Well, it outlined a sweeping set of principles for a just and lasting peace. Critically, it called for the establishment of a multinational organization to guarantee global peace, what he termed a League of Nations.
The League of Nations, his big idea.
He considered it the keystone of the whole program. Other key points included calls for self-determination for the peoples of Austria-Hungary and the Ottoman Empire, open diplomacy, freedom of the seas, a real blueprint for a new world order.
And the entry of the American Expeditionary Forces under General Pershing, that made a difference on the battlefield.
Oh, huge difference. Provided much needed morale boost and crucial military strength to the exhausted Allied forces. They played a decisive role in defeating the German army on the Western Front, ultimately contributing to the armistice signed on November 11th, 1918, bringing that horrific conflict finally to an end.
And on the home front, how did he manage the war effort?
Wilson delegated significant authority to his war cabinet, established powerful new agencies like the War Industries Board, which centralized economic planning, and the Food Administration, led by Herbert Hoover, implementing rationing and conservation efforts.
Hoover got his start there.
Yep. The federal budget just soared from $1 billion to an astonishing $19
billion. $19 billion. How did they pay for it?
The War Revenue Acts of 1917 and 1918 significantly raised taxes, including introducing an excess profits tax. Marked a major, lasting shift in government revenue generation.
And managing public opinion during this huge conflict.
He established the Committee on Public Information, the CPI, under George Creel. This was essentially the first modern propaganda office.
Yeah.
Used everything from four-minute men giving pro-war speeches in public places to posters and films.
Shaping the narrative.
Exactly. However, despite his strong leadership during the war, Wilson's political standing at home weakened towards its end. In the 1918 off-year elections, Republicans, fueled partly by the alienation of German and Irish-American Democrats who felt targeted or unheard, they took control of both houses of Congress.
Oh, that's bad timing.
Terrible timing.
Yeah.
This shift created significant political challenges for Wilson, just as he was about to embark on his ambitious and ultimately doomed peace efforts in Europe. Hashtag tag V, post-war challenges, health crisis, and enduing legacy.
Following the armistice, Wilson embarked on what he genuinely hoped would be his crowning achievement. Forging a lasting peace at the Paris Peace Conference.
Right.
He made the unprecedented and controversial decision to travel to Europe and personally lead the American delegation. Became the first incumbent president to leave the country for such an extended period.
That certainly raises an important question. What motivated him to personally lead these complex negotiations? Breaking with established practice, facing criticism for being away from domestic affairs.
It really signaled his profound personal commitment, didn't it? Almost a messianic belief that he alone could ensure his vision of a just peace and the League of Nations would prevail. He truly saw himself as the architect of a new world order.
What's equally striking, though, and perhaps an early misstep with profound repercussions, is that he purposefully excluded prominent Republicans from his official delegation.
Like who?
Including Lodge. Henry Cabot Lodge, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Wow. The guy whose committee would have to ratify the treaty, he excluded him?
Yep. This decision, driven by Wilson's deep distrust of his political opponents, immediately fueled intense partisan battles back home, particularly with Lodge, who had become his fierce antagonist. Mm. This move, maybe more than anything, poisoned the well for the treaty's eventual ratification.
So despite his soaring idealism, his 14 points, Wilson ultimately found himself making several difficult concessions to the other Allied powers, Britain, France, Italy, to secure the establishment of his beloved League of Nations.
What kind of concessions?
Agreeing to harsh terms for Germany, significant loss of territory, crippling reparations payments, a deeply resented war guilt clause placing sole blame on Germany, military occupation of the Rhineland.
pretty harsh. Didn't sound like his peace without victory.
Not really. And he also, perhaps most paradoxically, given his commitment to self-determination, accepted the expansion of Allied and Japanese empires through League of Nations mandates.
Mandates. What were those?
Essentially, thinly disguised colonies in the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. This move directly undercut his earlier promise of self-government, especially concerning China's Shandong Peninsula, which was handed over to Japan, sparking outrage in China.
Wow. So he compromised quite a bit on his principles.
He did. But what's truly fascinating here is the stark contrast between these difficult compromises and the international recognition he received. Despite the challenges to his vision, the harsh realities of the peace treaty, his tireless efforts toward peace, particularly his advocacy for the League, earned him the 1919 Nobel Peace Prize.
Nobel Prize winner, even as the treaty had these flaws.
Exactly. Underscores the global recognition of his ambitious pursuit of a new world order, even as its implementation was fraught with complexity and its terms, arguably, sowed the seeds for future conflicts.
However, the real and ultimately insurmountable battle began back home in the United States. The defeat of the Treaty of Versailles in the Senate.
Right. Ratification required a two-thirds majority, and crucially, Republicans controlled the Senate. The ensuing debate was deeply ideological, centered on America's role in the world, and specifically, Article X of the League Covenant.
Article X, what was the issue there?
This article seemed to bind member nations to defend one another against aggression. Many senators feared this would drag the U.S. into future European wars without congressional approval, infringing on American sovereignty and the constitutional power of Congress to declare war.
A legitimate concern, constitutionally speaking.
Absolutely. Senators quickly divided into three main factions. The Irreconcilables, a small but vocal group who opposed the League entirely, saw it as abandoning American isolationism.
Okay.
The Reservationists, led by Senator Lodge, who accepted the League in principle, but demanded significant modifications or reservations to protect U.S. sovereignty and congressional prerogatives.
Lodge's group.
And most Democrats, who generally favored the treaty as Wilson had negotiated it.
So this raises an important question. Why was Wilson so utterly unwilling to compromise with reservationists like Senator Lodge? Lodge proposed 10 specific modifications that might have secured ratification. Why wouldn't Wilson budge?
His reasoning, perhaps tragically, seems twofold. He feared reopening negotiations with other treaty signatories to incorporate U.S. reservations would unravel the entire agreement. And his own increasing physical and mental inflexibility, exacerbated by his declining health, made him just unyielding.
Stubbornness, basically.
You could call it that. Ultimately, Wilson's steadfast refusal to compromise proved to be its undoing. In a dramatic, highly controversial move, he himself instructed his loyal Democratic supporters to vote against the modified treaty.
Against his own treaty, with modifications.
Yes, believing only the original unamended version truly embodied his vision. This decision led directly to its defeat, not once, but twice. As the historian Thomas A. Bailey famously called it, this was the supreme act of infanticide, stating the treaty was slain in the house of its friends by Wilson and his docile following. It was a tragic, deeply ironic end to his grand international vision, a personal defeat that would haunt him.
In a desperate effort to rally public support for the League and pressure the Senate, Wilson embarked on that exhausting cross-country barnstorming tour of the Western states.
Right, trying to take his case directly to the people.
But tragically, the immense strain proved too much. His health deteriorated rapidly. On October 2nd, 1919, he suffered a serious stroke.
The stroke? How bad was it?
Very bad. It left him paralyzed on his left side with only partial vision in his right eye and profoundly diminished his cognitive abilities.
So this had profound, almost unimaginable implications for governing the nation.
Absolutely. He was confined to bed, largely secluded, shielded by his devoted second wife, Edith Bowling Galt Wilson, and his personal physician, Rear Admiral Carey Grayson.
His second wife, Ellen, had died earlier.
Yes. Ellen died in 1914. He remarried Edith in December 1915. And his illness, as later accounts would confirm, tragically affected his personality, made him prone to disorders of emotion, impaired impulse control, and defective judgment. A devastating physical and mental blow for a president at such a critical juncture in world history.
During this period of severe incapacitation, Edith Wilson, along with his physician and chief of staff, effectively controlled all access to him, determined which documents he'd read, which decisions required his attention.
So she was essentially running things.
This extraordinary situation led some contemporary critics and later historians to describe Edith Wilson as, quite literally, the first female president of the United States, due to her significant, unprecedented influence during his nearly year-long period of profound executive disability.
Wow, the first female president.
His true physical and mental condition wasn't publicly known until February 1920. It raised widespread, deeply disturbing concerns about his fitness to govern amidst major domestic and international crises. It was a constitutional crisis quietly unfolding behind closed doors.
And the post-war period at home was also marked by significant, widespread domestic turmoil, compounding the challenges of the incapacitated president.
Yeah, what was happening domestically?
4 million soldiers were demobilized with woefully few benefits or support systems, led to widespread unemployment, social unrest, widespread industrial strikes, millions of workers demanding better pay and conditions disrupted the economy, and a severe, sharp economic depression hit in 1920. Added to the national anxiety.
A volatile time.
Extremely. This volatile climate fueled the first Red Scare, an intense period of anti-radical hysteria spurred by fears of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia and a series of anarchist bombings across the U.S. Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer with little oversight from the ailing Wilson.
Right. Wilson was incapacitated.
Launched the infamous Palmer raids, arresting thousands of suspected radicals without due process, deporting many.
And wasn't there also significant racial violence?
Yes. What's equally, if not more, disturbing here is that a series of devastating race riots swept the nation in the summers of 1917 and 1919, a period often called the Red Summer due to the bloodshed.
Red Summer. Cities like
East St. Louis, Chicago, Omaha erupted in racial violence, resulting in hundreds of African-American deaths, widespread destruction. And what's deeply disturbing is that the federal government, despite public outcry and the severity of the violence, largely did not intervene directly in these riots, though Wilson did speak out against lynching in 1918, a rare public acknowledgement of racial injustice.
So on other critical social fronts, the 18th Amendment, Prohibition, was ratified in 1919.
Right. Wilson, though personally opposed, ultimately vetoed the Volstead Act for its enforcement mechanism, but Congress swiftly overrode his veto.
And interestingly, demonstrating his capacity for political evolution, Wilson initially opposed women's suffrage.
He did. I thought he supported it.
Initially, no. But he gradually reversed his position. Due to compelling evidence of women voters' behavior in Western states, which demonstrated their civic engagement, and crucially, the political necessity of securing their support for the war effort and his international agenda.
Political calculation again.
Partly, yes. He ultimately pressured the Senate to pass the 19th Amendment, which was ratified in August 1920, finally granting women the right to vote nationwide. So what does this all mean? It shows a capacity for political evolution, even on deeply held beliefs, driven by political realities, observed outcomes, and the sheer force of a powerful social movement.
Despite his profound incapacity and isolation, Wilson, in a testament to his ambition, perhaps his detached grasp of reality, actually harbored a desire for a third term.
Seriously.
After the stroke.
Seriously. However, the Democrats, recognizing his health condition, nominated James M. Cox. The nation, exhausted by war and reform, ultimately yearned for a return to normalcy.
Harding's slogan.
Exactly. Republican Warren G. Harding won the 1920 election in a landslide, campaigning on that very promise, effectively repudiating Wilson's progressive policies and an internationalist vision.
Wilson's health, sadly, didn't significantly improve after leaving office in 1921. He made a brief attempt at a law practice, tried to write, but with limited success. The lingering effects of his stroke severely hindered his capabilities. He continued to follow politics from the sidelines as President Harding systematically undid many of his policies, including efforts to join the League of Nations. Woodrow Wilson died peacefully on February 3, 1924 at age 67, and holds the unique distinction of being the only president interred in Washington National Cathedral.
Now, we arrive at the complex and frankly often contradictory core of Wilson's enduring legacy. This raises an absolutely essential, deeply challenging question for us.
Which is?
How do we, as historians, as citizens, reconcile Wilson's truly progressive domestic policies, his visionary calls for global peace, his expansion of democratic principles abroad, with his deeply troubling and regressive racial record at home?
It is a stark, painful contrast. Born to parents who actively supported slavery and the Confederacy, his early intellectual development saw him academically become an apologist for slavery, a fervent promoter of the Lost Cause mythology,
That romanticized historical narrative, which downplayed slavery's role in the Civil War, glorified the Confederacy, justified racial hierarchy.
Exactly. This intellectual foundation deeply colored his later decisions. As we discussed at Princeton, he actively discouraged African-American admissions, a policy that stood in direct opposition to the gradual integration occurring at some other elite institutions.
And as president, the impact of these views was immediate and devastating. He allowed, and in many cases actively facilitated, the widespread imposition of segregation within the federal bureaucracy, systematically overturning decades of fragile progress made since Reconstruction.
How did that happen specifically?
Postmaster General Albert S. Burleson, a staunch segregationist, aggressively urged segregation. Wilson granted cabinet secretaries broad discretion, which quickly led to segregated workspaces, restrooms, cafeterias, and departments like the Navy, Treasury, Post Office by late 1913.
So resegregating the federal government?
Effectively, yes. His administration also systematically fired many black supervisors appointed by Taft, implemented policies like requiring photos for civil service applications that effectively served to increase racial discrimination in federal hiring.
And the impact extended to the military as well.
Oh, yes. Segregation in the armed forces intensified dramatically under his administration, particularly in the Navy, where black sailors who had previously served in integrated roles were relegated almost entirely to menial mess and custodial duties.
So these policies profoundly disappointed, alienated the very African-Americans who had supported him, believing in his progressive promises.
Absolutely. Some historians describe him as not merely insensitive, but actively hostile to black equality. One poignant study found his segregationist policies within the federal government measurably increased the black-white earnings gap by 3.4-6.9 percentage points, highlighting the very real, measurable, lasting harm his actions caused.
Yet, despite these severe, undeniable criticisms regarding race and his inflexibility on the Treaty of Versailles, historians generally continue to rank Wilson as an above-average president. How does that work?
Well, he is widely considered a key figure in establishing modern American liberalism. His landmark accomplishments like the Federal Reserve, the FTC, his approach to government intervention, they profoundly influenced later presidents like FDR and LBJ, shaped the direction of the American state for generations.
It is Wilsonianism, that idealistic foreign policy based on collective security, democracy, self-determination,
that profoundly influenced international relations, laid the intellectual and practical groundwork for the development of the United Nations. However, he's also heavily criticized for his significant curtailment of civil liberties during wartime, the Espionage and Sedition Acts, his repeated military interventions in Latin America, and, of course, his failure to secure ratification of the Treaty of Versailles, which arguably contributed to the instability leading to World War II.
And from a different ideological perspective, conservatives often criticize his expansion of the federal government, its regulatory powers.
Right. Some call him a progenitor of today's imperial presidency, arguing he set precedents for a powerful, centralized executive branch. This enduring duality, these stark contrasts in his legacy, they're ever present in discussions of his place in history.
So while numerous memorials to him exist across the globe, reflecting his international stature, it's also notable that some institutions, like his alma mater Princeton,
have recently removed his name from certain public spaces and academic programs due to his deeply problematic racial views, reflecting a changing, more critical understanding of how we honor historical figures.
So what does this all mean for us as we reflect on Woodrow Wilson? We've delved into this remarkable journey of a man born in the post-Civil War South, who rose from academic obscurity to become a transformative president. We've seen him as the architect of modern economic and labor policies, a visionary for international peace through the League of Nations, a wartime leader who brought America to the global stage, forever altering its international role.
But we've also squarely faced the painful, undeniable truth of his regressive racial policies, policies which inflicted lasting damage on millions of Americans and stand as a stark, unforgivable contrast to his otherwise progressive ideals.
Understanding Wilson helps us grapple with a complex, often contradictory tapestry of American history.
It really does.
It illustrates how grand visions and profound impacts for the good can tragically coexist with deeply ingrained prejudices. It challenges us to look beyond simplistic narratives, appreciate the full, often unsettling humanity of historical figures, acknowledging both their monumental achievements and their grave moral failings.
Consider this. Woodrow Wilson sought to make the world safe for democracy through global cooperation, the principle of self-determination, envisioning a future where nations respected each other's sovereignty.
Right, his big international vision.
Yet at the very same time, he actively sanctioned and expanded racial segregation at home, undermining the very democratic ideals he championed abroad for his own citizens. What does this profound paradox tell us about the nature of ideals versus their implementation?
Hmm.
How do societal biases, even deeply embedded ones, shadow and compromise the legacy of even the most ambitious and globally minded leaders? And ultimately, how do we measure the true legacy of someone whose light shone so brightly on the world stage, yet cast such a long, dark shadow over a significant portion of his own people?
Life is unpredictable, but how you prepare for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. Whether to cover debts and routine expenses or even invest the money and earn interest over time. With Policy Genius, finding and buying life insurance is simple. You can compare quotes from top insurers and could find coverage that fits your needs and your budget. Plus, they offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. It's an easy way to feel good about and plan for the future. No wonder Policy Genius is the country's leading online insurance marketplace. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to policygenius.com to compare top-rated life insurance policies, get your lowest quote, and make a smart move in under 10 minutes. That's policygenius.com.